Hello and welcome to Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking to mitigate reckless and destructive development. This program aims to increase your ecological intelligence, to encourage you to think globally and act locally, and to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. Today's program is about permafrost, and specifically the impact that warmer temperatures are having on the melting permafrost that covers some 24% of the Northern Hemisphere. I spoke with Dr. Sean Carey. Dr. Carey directs the Watershed Hydrology Group at the School of Geography and Earth Sciences at McMaster University, and his research interests include hydrological, biochemical, and land surface processes in natural and human-impacted environments.
Hi, my name is Dr. Sean Carey. I'm a professor in the School of Geography and Earth Sciences at McMaster University.
Okay. Welcome to the program. Today we're going to talk about permafrost. It's been in the news, but it's sort of coming up to the forefront because people recognize it's just north of us. Tell us how you started to be interested in the permafrost.
Yeah, what most Canadians don't realize, I think, is that half of the country is underlain by permafrost. So half of the country has ground that essentially is frozen all the time. And it's a lot away from our southern centers, but it's sort of a really important sort of aspect of our Canadian ecosystems. I've been traveling to Canada's north since 1995. I've been studying watersheds in and around the Yukon, trying to understand how climate change, permafrost thaw, and these sort of issues are affecting the water, carbon, and energy cycle in these northern ecosystems because they're particularly vulnerable when the permafrost does degrade.
Okay, and let's do a permafrost 101. Tell us what the challenge is. You talked about the water. Most people, if they think about the permafrost melting because the temperature is increasing, they think, okay, carbon or methane goes into the atmosphere. So give us the basics.
Yeah, permafrost is, I guess, technically defined as ground that is below 0 degrees Celsius for more than 2 years, but that's sort of a textbook definition. It's basically ground that's been frozen for a long period of time, and I think there are lots of challenges. There's geotechnical challenge, there's challenges to, you know, with the release of greenhouse gases and other sort of things like that, but I think one of the biggest challenges is that within the permafrost, permafrost is a technical term. It could be frozen rock, it could be frozen soil, but there's a lot of ice in permafrost. And the big issue comes that when we melt this ice that exists within the permafrost, the ground degrades. So there's you can imagine a structure that is 2 meters high and underneath it is 1 meter of rock and 1 meter of ice, and when that ice disappears, the ground sinks a meter. And so any sort of building structure, any sort of bridges, any sort of infrastructure falls apart. That's the geotechnical aspect. Then there are these global aspects whereby there's a lot of methane locked up in permafrost and permafrost ice. As the soil's warm, microbes start chewing at this carbon that's been sequestered for tens of thousands of years, and that, you know, contributes more to the greenhouse gas contributions above and beyond our industrial activities.
Now, the permafrost is not just a certain thickness. It can be anywhere from 3 feet to 4,000 feet.
Yeah.
What makes the difference?
Just temperature. Permafrost is just frozen ground. As we travel north, even in northern Ontario, you start to pick up pockets of permafrost in wetlands, in areas where there's really thick organic soils. But as we traverse Canada and move farther north, essentially it's like a wedge. It's really thin at one end and sporadic. And as we move north, it becomes thicker and thicker and thicker. And areas of the high Arctic islands, it's thousands of about 1,000 meter deep, hundreds of meters deep. So it's very permanent, and that's not going anywhere anytime soon. But there's a lot of places at the southern end of the permafrost that it's degrading quite rapidly in front of our eyes.
Right. Now, the permafrost, other than the 4,000 feet, that's quite substantial. When you're talking about 3 feet below that, you're talking about the same kind of...
Yeah.
Soil and rock that's underneath everything else.
Exactly. And so they exist in these sort of, you can imagine it's sort of little... I don't know what you'd call them, sort of chocolate chips and muffins. I mean, at the southern end, there's areas of frozen ground, but among that, it's thawed ground, just like here. But there's areas of southern, sort of southern territories, northern provinces that have this discontinuous permafrost. And where there's permafrost, there's lots of ice in it. And the problems occur when this ice thaws, the landscape collapses. And we call this thermokarst. And this thermokarst has really sort of strange and wide-ranging implications for water quality, how indigenous communities traverse the land, nutrients in rivers. So this is sort of the canary in the gold mine of permafrost thaw as it stands right now.
And Canada, being one of the largest nations and with a large amount of permafrost, is at the forefront. We're all concerned about the temperatures increasing by 1.5% or 2 degrees Celsius. Why is it such an impact on Canada and the northern climes?
Yeah, you know, people talk about the 1.5, the 2 degrees Celsius increase. And, you know, in my 25 years since I've been working in the north, it's increased more than that. In the past 50 years, temperatures in the northwest Canada have increased much more than 2 degrees. So we talk about these 2 degrees, but in the north, you know, the warming is amplified. There are areas of the north that have warmed up instrumentally. So this isn't, you know, this is from the thermometers, people checking them in the winter over 7, 8, 9 degrees. And so these are having really, really strong impacts that we just can't keep the ground cool. And so these areas that are having accelerated warming, and, you know, are having accelerated thaw. And you think it's just the 0 degrees, right? It's the difference between ground being frozen and ground not being frozen. So here, it warms up 1 or 2 degrees, just gets warmer. At a place where it's around zero or below zero, it crosses that sort of freezing threshold. Mm-hmm. The entire ecosystem changed from one that's likes to be frozen to one that's not. And so we're sort of trying to understand and deal with those changes.
And what happens when the permafrost does thaw? What happens to the ecosystem?
It really depends on where you are. This is sort of what all the sort of scientists love to study. It's probably keeping scientists employed for the next 50 years. It really, my gut feeling is it depends on where the ice is. There's places that are not really icy. The ground is frozen. It thaws. People don't see too much. Plants get happier. There's a real increase in shrub abundance in the Arctic, and that's something we've really noticed, that as it warms up, there's more nutrients in the soil. Shrubs can trap more snow. They grow larger and larger. Some ecosystems, they don't seem to, you know, people are always looking for the smoking gun they can't see. And there's other ecosystems that are just changing dramatically as the landscape falls apart. So there's a real variable response, but the response is pretty marked. I mean, of all the sort of ecosystem responses to temperature changes, there's no place other than permafrost systems where you'll really notice it.
What do you say to the people that say, global warming, bring it on?
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time in Whitehorse and some of these places, and they say it up there too, largely because it's pretty cold. I think it's, you know, I really try to stay dispassionate and out of the sort of political side of things. I think, you know, it's best served understanding the science and the nature of the science behind these sort of things. I think it's a little too easy to get caught up in the sort of thing. But, you know, there's no doubt there's people in the north. They don't mind the nice summers. They don't mind the warm winters. I think the flip side is it when the infrastructure and the buildings are falling down and the roads are collapsing. You just have to take a drive from Whitehorse to Dawson and bottom your truck out a number of times because of thawing permafrost beneath the road. So there are pluses and minuses and all these sorts of things, I suppose.
So let's go back to something you said earlier. The microbes and the plant life actually thrives a bit mm-hmm. better. The more plants grow on the permafrost or in the tundra, what's the problem with that?
So the problem is that as it stands right now, there's a massive amount of carbon that's stored in these permafrost soils. It's a huge percentage of the global carbon terrestrial stocks. And what happens is, so this is often frozen or it's very cold. And as we sort of thaw, as this permafrost thaws, you're able to access much more sort of bioavailable carbon. So microbes, you know, they warm up, they see this sort of food that's great to eat, they sort of munch on it, it oxidizes, becomes CO2 in the atmosphere. And so we have this really large CO2 sort of, you know, increase that essentially is from warming soils and newly available, really, really bioavailable organic material. There's also the aspect of methanogens that sort of chew on organic material in anaerobic, so where it's sort of waterlogged conditions. So there are these two sort of competing factors that they've access to all this new available organic carbon, and there's a massive amount of it. And this is sort of what the, you know, people call it the carbon bomb, et cetera, et cetera. There's a huge debate in science about how much this really is a risk. It, maybe 10 years ago, everyone thought this was going to be the end of times, and people have sort of walked it back a little bit. But it's unknown, and it's there. I mean, you can do back of the envelope calculations about, you know, its radiative forcing, and it's pretty significant. And the growing plants simply can't offset that source. So if we grow more plants, sure, they can vacuum up a little more CO2 and sort of, you know, through photosynthesis and these processes. But the available carbon there for microbial decomposition is just so massive that that's the great concern.
And water plays an important role as well. So like if you've got a skating rink, and the spring comes along, the ice gets thinner and thinner until you can't skate on it anymore. What's the challenge with water up in the permafrost?
Yeah, you know, one of the big challenges, it's not necessarily a permafrost, but it's somewhat related, is that we use ice roads a lot in the north. I mean, this is one of the big ways that we can get, you know, supplies to remote communities. Often that's the only way they get their fuel in and out. Ice roads are a precarious situation now compared to where they were. And as far as degrading permafrost, it really like the infrastructure, but the one thing that we've really also noticed is that as permafrost thaws, the pathways which water moves to the river, whether it be through the ground, it's taking different pathways. As the ground thaws, new deeper pathways show up. It's getting warmer, melts earlier, and so a lot of people who are used to using the river for you know, sort of hunting and other purposes, a lot of indigenous communities, just the way the river is very different now. So it's causing real challenges for navigation, real challenges for hunting, and they're not able to get into some of the places that they were able to get into just because the levels of the rivers have changed. It also impacts water quality. If water flows over the surface, now it flows beneath the surface, it's going to have very different water quality impacts, including thermocarst. So we're seeing now in the north real changes in water quality, water temperature, and just water flow regimes that are all occurring, we believe, because the permafrost is thawing.
And under the permafrost, there's the soil, there's always groundwater. Yep. And if that heats up, then you've got a combination of the sun's rays hitting the top of the permafrost and the water underneath warming it from beneath, and you've got a double whammy.
Yeah, the groundwater's made most, well, some places far up north don't really have much groundwater. The groundwater is just below the rivers. But it's these areas in the subarctic where there is a decent groundwater contribution that's increasing. It's cool water. Groundwater is always fairly cool. The increasing river temperatures really are just largely because it's warmer. I mean, it's, as I say, there's, you know, I've lived in and around southern Ontario most of my life, and it, I don't know, it seems maybe a little warmer here than it was, but things are the same. It's pretty amazing when you spend enough time in the north, and it's shocking to see the change in front of your eyes.
More,
you know,
dramatic,
it's dramatic, yeah. And it's, you talk to people and it's like, well, it used to be like this and now it's like this, and this is in, you know, decades, not centuries.
So we've talked about the flora. What about the fauna? What about migration patterns? Are they affected?
Yeah, I don't know too much about animals, but I think it's like all things. I mean, the permafrost degradation, you know, affects lower order animals, but when you talk about caribou and polar bears, et cetera, I'm not sure that's their big risk. But the climate impacts that it's had in the north is pretty substantial. You know, I think one of the big things that we notice now is that it rains a lot more than it used to. I was up in Whitehorse in January. It was plus 5 degrees Celsius, and it had rained, and they used to never get winter rains, mm-hmm. and this affects caribou's ability to break through the snow to get grass. It's not a permafrost thing, but it's all in the north. Everything is sort of, you know, really highly interconnected and really changing.
Now, here's a scary thing. In Russia, I believe, they uncovered a carcass from an animal had been frozen for who knows how long.
Yeah.
And it had pathogens in it.
Yeah, that's right. I think this is the thing that, I don't know if it excites people the most, because it sounds like a Hollywood movie, right? It's sort of a, you know, I remember when it happened, there was a whole bunch of buzz about, you know, yeah, we're all going to die of some secret anthrax or whatever it is. And, you know, these risks are real. I don't think they're these are sort of natural pathogens which exist in our environment. I mean, you know, sort of bubonic plague, anthrax, these are soil bacteria that exist. And it's not something I would lose much sleep about. I'd lose much more sleep about basically our crumbling infrastructure, pipelines that would potentially be tried to build across permafrost that would break. These are sort of big, major environmental problems. I think the caribou or the, you know, woolly mammoth coming out and people eating it, I think that it's You know, I could be wrong. It would make for a good Hollywood thriller, but I don't think it's I don't think that's sort of our top of the list and sort of the problems that we're going to be dealing with. Hopefully,
but knock on wood. But it does serve to heighten the fact that we're not just affecting the last 10 years or 100 years. We're reaching back to thousands.
Yeah,
of years.
I mean, it's been cold. I mean, it's funny. It's been cold for a long time, and we're sort of at this point where hasn't been this warm in a long time. You know, there people will, you know, kind of say, well, there were sort of periods in the Middle Ages that were warm, but, you know, we're on a track that it hasn't been this warm in you know, pre-human history, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is where we're going. So it's these are areas of the north that have been thawed for hundreds of thousands of years, you know, tens to hundreds of thousands of years. So it's a real, real sea change in what's going on up there.
Right, right. And the fact that 24% of the exposed landmass of the northern hemisphere is considered permafrost.
Yeah, I mean,
you're not talking a small part way up north. It's
big. You know, all us Canadians were shoved pretty close to the U.S. border and don't notice these things. But when you fly across Canada, you know, chances are you've looked at permafrost at some point. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty pervasive, and the problem is it creates challenges in communities that are least able to deal with the challenges because of infrastructure, because of, you know, just the level of support that occurs in the north.
So what can we do to help mitigate this or adapt to it?
Yeah, you know, I guess that's the question. I suppose mitigation and adaptation is probably the way to think as opposed to stopping it. I think it's a shame that, you know, really we don't focus as much on cold environments and permafrost environments as we did 30, 40, 50 years ago when they were building the Alaska pipeline, they were developing, you know, northern communities. We had a real expertise in sort of permafrost engineering and permafrost science, and we've almost lost that. It's amazing. I go to these meetings and all the expertise is with people over 65, and we don't have big courses on permafrost science anymore. And we really need to sort of wake up and really address this. And we had a course at McMaster when I first arrived that was teaching people about cold environments and permafrost, and now it's off the books. It was a well-regarded course. It's just not in people's consciousness. I think it's something that, you know, we have a hard time as Canadians really understanding the North because very few Canadians have been to the North. And
right,
I think when you go there, it sort of is a bit of a change in attitude.
Now, there was a book not too long ago that, and I forget the name of the title, but it was something along the lines of Give Us the Cold or Keep Us in the Cold. Sheila.
Oh, Watt Cloutier. Yeah, yes. Yeah. The loss of cold.
Loss of cold.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty big deal, right? I mean, I think the fact that those most vulnerable to climate change in the north are indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the challenges that exist are substantial. And it's not just, you know, people saying, oh, it's warmer, it's better. But I mean, when you rely on ice, when you rely on your ability to traverse the land, to reach your trap lines, and all of a sudden permafrost is degrading and you can't get from A to B, these are really important and kind of sad sort of consequences of climate change.
Right. So let's dial it back again. How much of a difference are we talking? 1 degree, 2 degrees?
Well, you know, it depends on where you are. I mean, you know, what the projection is. I sort of, you know, people always say the new norm. I don't know if there's a norm. I think we're on a road somewhere. And the bottom line is it seems like every single prediction we've made about changes in the north and the consequences of the change in the north has been an underestimate. And I think that's what scares me the most, is that whether it be sea ice or permafrost temperatures or degradation, we are beyond all of our worst predictions for change. And as I say, sea ice is a classic example, but even ground temperatures, people thought temperatures that were stable and cold, they're warming up. And I mean, I'm the last thing from an alarmist, but it's sort of It's pretty concerning when you see these changes. Where it's going to go, I'm not sure, but I think the whole of the north is subject to change. But most of the major changes will be in the south, where we're just, you know, if you're at temperatures -1, -2, -3, and it's now +1, +2, you have changed from a cold state to a warm state. Mm-hmm. If you're -18, we're going to -15. Mm-hmm. You know, you're still going to be pretty cold. But a lot of Canada is right on that cusp, you know, and it's sort of, there's a lot of resource development, there's a lot of, you know, industry that's operating, oil and gas, mining, and, you know, so this is the area that we really have to watch.
In the way of adaptation, we're talking about modifying pipelines that cross the tundra, We're talking about stabilizing the footings for buildings, as you mentioned earlier. You know, when a building sort of collapses into the soil, and it wasn't because of a tsunami or a hurricane, it just was there one day and it fell in the next day. Can we get ahead of this?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have the ability and we know how to build on permafrost. There's, you know, millions of people that live on permafrost. It's just, you know, it costs, right? You know, you go to these sort of places and the extra engineering costs that exist to stabilize and put down gravel and the thermosiphons and things to keep the ground cold, it costs a lot of money. And it's something that usually doesn't happen over a day. It usually happens over time when you notice, oh, my building's cracking. Oh, my floor is, you know, collapsing. And take trips around the Yukon and in central Alaska, and it's always good for photographs. You can see all these buildings that are tipping over, et cetera, as the permafrost thaws underneath them. But it's, it's something we can certainly get ahead of. I'm not too, I think the bigger infrastructure projects, the pipelines, these sort of things, they're much more delicate, for lack of a better term, but they've built pipelines on permafrost before. And you know, I think that the engineering know-how was there. Whether it's still there, we'll see.
So what can our listeners do listening here in you know, North America or wherever? When you say the North, it's way up there. You have to really wrap your head around it. You've been up there, you've visited quite often. You've got a better sense of what's going on. So what can we do to make this topic a bit more important?
That's a good question. And I'm not sure I have an answer, like an actionable answer to say, you know, turn your taps off or, you know, trade in your Escalade for a Tesla or something. But I think the one thing I encourage everyone to do is travel to the North. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's going to Hawaii or the Caribbean and places like this. And very few Canadians put, places like Labrador, Northern Quebec, Northern Ontario. There's lots of places that are accessible, Yukon and Yellowknife. People go to the North and are transformed, particularly in the summer when it's beautiful. It's, you know, it's light all the time. You can read a paper 24 hours a day and it's, it changes people. And I think that basically the experience of going to the North and as part of Canada, I think that will probably do more to raise awareness and sort of get people actioning on things than sort of anything around the home. Probably the tourist companies thank me for saying that.
Yeah, it's part of Canada. Yeah. You want to be the East Coast, the West Coast, and you mentioned, you know, as it's not too far, Northern Ontario, Labrador, et cetera, et cetera. And they've got the all-season road up to Tuktoyaktuk.
Yeah. So I was just a few weeks ago, up the road, the Dempster Highway. We didn't go all the way to Tuck, but I've driven it all the way to Inuvik, and one of these days I'll make the extra, you know, whatever it is, 80 kilometers up to Tuktoyaktuk. I was reading in the paper this morning, though, that, there's no hotels or anything, so people go back to Inuvik because they get there and they're okay. But it's
dip your toe in the
ocean and then head back down. But it's but just driving up in these places, we were going from Dawson to sort of the Yukon Northwest Territory border. You pass three mountain ranges, and it's the colors, and no one's there. And it sort of strikes you as Canada's a big place, and we're all sort of huddled up here next to the lake.
To finalize things, try and give us a glimmer of hope. You're involved in the research. Tell us, there are a lot of people looking at this, and maybe some solutions will come forward.
A glimmer of hope. I mean, I'm not a negative person. I'm not a positive person. I think I'm fairly dispassionate about it. I think that you know, we do tend to always look at things on the dark side. And I think that sort of there are certainly negative consequences to everything. But, I mean, there are positive consequences to warming in the North largely for people who live there. I mean, it sort of makes people a little happier when Whitehorse is a little warmer and sunnier. I mean, and there are a lot of changes that'll be sort of what you'd call no big deal. I mean, the Earth is always changing. It's not sort of something we're trying to keep the Earth as it was in 1971 forever, right? I mean, and some of these changes will just be changes that are completely manageable, completely adaptable, and just this is sort of, humans have been living with changes for, you know, thousands of years. So I wouldn't always be so doom and gloom about it. I think that's sort of the nature of the scientist, to be a bit doomy and gloomy, to get a little more sort of alarm bells for their work. And there's lots of alarms, but I still think there's so much we don't understand, and a lot of it's just, you know, I think the big thing we have to do, and it's sort of something that's not very engaging for governments is we just have to keep our eyes out better. There's very little people that monitor in the north. There's very little data. There's very little people there. I think if you're going to invest in something is at least to be able to observe, understand the changes as they happen and what causes them. And I think our ability to even observe the changes now is really poor. And I think we're going to be surprised because we will see things after they'd happen as opposed to when they're happening. So I would just, you know, invest in improving our monitoring infrastructure, whether it be for weather, whether it be for water, whether it be for these sort of things, vegetation.
Right, right. Well, thank you for the work that you're doing, Dr. Carey.
All right.
Thank you for being on Earth Matters.
Thank you very much.